The headlines: European Union unleashes new sanctions against Iran over an alleged supply of drones to Russia in the Ukraine war. The political crisis facing Liz Truss is expanding, with a Tory lawmaker submitting a letter of no confidence in the British premier. And also in our headlines, a general strike in the occupied West Bank to commemorate a young Palestinian who was killed by Israeli forces in a confrontation. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the European Union unveils a new set of sanctions targeting Iran over allegations that it's been supplying drones to Russia to aid Ukraine. In a tweet, the Czech presidency of the EU has announced that the bloc will take restrictive measures against entities supplying Iranian drones to Russia to be used in the Ukraine war. The tweet also says that EU member states have decided to freeze the assets of three individuals and one entity responsible for drone deliveries to Moscow. Russia is denying Western reports about the use of Iranian UAVs and has already warned the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran, and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia for the use in the conflict in Ukraine. And I would recommend that you do not underestimate technological capabilities of the Russian drone industry. I can tell you we know what we do and we know how to do it. But I can tell you that, first of all, the press secretary of the president said that they are Russian-made. Secondly, when you see the debris on the ground after they hit the targets, you would see inscriptions in Russian on the shell. So I don't think that Russian is very much widely used in Iran. I
also heard that addressing a UN Security Council session, Polyansky said the claims by the Western states are nothing but conspiracy theories. He warned that Moscow would reassess its cooperation with UN Chief Antonio Guterres if the world body carries out an investigation into the origins of the drones. Speaking to reporters in New York, the Iranian UN envoy also dismissed the drone allegations as unsubstantiated and politically motivated. Amir Saidi Ravani said Iran has all along called for an end to the war in Ukraine and invited the warring sides to exercise self-restraint. Tehran has already urged Ukraine to provide evidence to back up its claims. Historian and author Markus Papadopoulos says the European Union is not independent in its political decision-makings, which is why he believes the decision for the latest sanctions against Iran was not made in Brussels.
I do believe that we need to consider as to whether the concept behind the Europeans having placed sanctions on Iran were truly conceived in Brussels, or were they actually conceived in Washington? Because we know very well that the United States government exerts tremendous influence in the European Union, specifically in Berlin and Paris. And Germany and France constitute the engine of the European Union. And we also know that the Germans and the French privately have very grave reservations about placing sanctions on the Russian economy and sending vast amounts of financial assistance to the Ukrainian government and considerable amounts of military equipment to the Ukrainian government.
News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, Iran's foreign minister says sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. He made the statement during a visit to Iran's EB House, an NGO which supports patients with rare skin disorders. Salman Kujiri reports.
Iran's foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, has paid a visit to EB House, an NGO supporting patients suffering from a rare skin disorder that causes the skin to become fragile, known as epidermolysis bullosa. During the visit, which came on the occasion of the EP Awareness Week, Iran's top diplomats said imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights.
Imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. There are 1,300 EB patients in Iran, but Sweden refuses to give special bandages to these patients. This comes as Westerners have repeatedly declared that sanctions do not include patients and medicine, but in practice, they act the opposite.
The Swedish company Mölnlycke Healthcare has refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation.
Iran has serious problems in procuring wound dressings for EB patients. These dressings are produced in Sweden, but the country refrains from providing us with the bandages because of the U.S. sanctions. Our center has filed a lawsuit in the judiciary of the Islamic Republic to pursue the problem, and we expect the Foreign Ministry and the administration of President Raisi to follow up the case because the lives of my daughter and other patients are in danger.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items. Tens of Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Swedish company Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. Since then, for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%. Iran says the West is taking revenge on Iranians by waging a campaign of genocide against patients, believing that the sanctions have become the backbone of the so-called American human rights regulations. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Masoud Shajadeh from the Islamic Human Rights Commission. And joining us from the British capital, London, and also from Tehran, we have political commentator Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Shajadeh in London. The U.S. exempts humanitarian imports from sanctions, but in practice, its secondary sanctions deter banks from participating in humanitarian transactions. So it seems that the U.S. is playing a double game of preserving its image as respecting Iranians' right to health, but at the same time, it's depriving them of access to essential medicines.
Absolutely. I mean, the reality is that the United States continuously claiming that these sanctions is nothing to do with the humanitarian and indeed medical equipment or medicine. But the reality is that the banks are too scared to have anything to do with anyone who's got any connection to Iran. And we have even seen dual nationals in Britain who have traveled to Iran and opened the access to their bank through the internet. Their banks have been shut down and their money sort of blockaded for months and months. We have had many of those cases. We've raised this issue, indeed, at the last session of the human rights in Geneva through oral statement. And the reality is that these sanctions have been weaponized, is actually resulting in killing people on one side, and is very selective. It's been used against opponents. It's not a tool to combat human rights abuses, as is claimed by United States, because we see no sanctions against places like sort of occupied Palestine, Zionist state, or indeed Saudi Arabia, which is abusing its own nations, nationals, and indeed nationals in Yemen. With sort of war crimes. And, we have, for example, a student in Britain, a Saudi student, for writing one tweet and sort of criticizing Saudi Arabia, got 36 years imprisonment. You know, there's nothing to stop that. There's no sanction against Khashoggi's barbaric murder or anything else. So these are really just weaponized. Sanctions are weaponized to sort of kill innocent people for a political purpose, and nothing to do with human rights, nothing to do with international justice or indeed fair play.
Hamid Zahedamzadeh, international rights groups say the economic sanctions are causing pain to Iranians with rare diseases who, in fact, need specialized treatment, including leukemia, the EB skin condition. We saw in the report epilepsy and those exposed to chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq war. Still, we see Western states, Sweden in the case of the EB patients, refusing to sell Iran these direly needed medicines, and patients are dying because of that. Why is that?
We should consider that basically the sanctions are supposed to target people in the target country. So not only these sanctions on the medicine and such things, but actually the all sanctions are actually considered to make people suffer in the countries that they are targeting, in this case, Iran. So basically all of them are putting people in trouble. In terms of medical issues and such patients that you just mentioned, again, it's not just about EB children and EB patients as well. We have other patients who are suffering from the sanctions as well. It is about cancer, about many other rare diseases. We have many people who are suffering from that. Either the medicine is not available for them, or it is very expensive because of the sanctions, because they need to be actually smuggled into the country. So again, it is not only EB children. It is everyone suffering in the country. And surprisingly, it is forbidden. It is against the international law to put sanctions on food and medicine. And you can see that no one across the world is opposing these sanctions. I remember my colleagues a couple of years ago tried to contact these factories, these companies of medical issues. Not only these particular one from Sweden, there were some companies in Switzerland as well, or in Germany, and none of them accepted to sell drugs to my colleagues at that time. They were doing the research on that, whether it is a rumor or really they are not. They are actually trying. They don't sell anything to you. That was correct. They actually do not sell anything. And they say the excuse is sanctions. And even at the time of during the Trump administration, when the Europeans said that they are establishing those INSTEX mechanism, which would be humanitarian, as they call it, and through which medicine would be available to Iranians, even at those times, this did not happen. And again, medicine was not allowed to be sold to Iranians, and the sanctions was in place. So, as I said, they are trying to put people into suffering in order to make them against their country, against their state. And that's the story. So if you think that the Americans would care for the patients, especially rare diseases, that's naive. No one in the American administration or even the European governments are concerned about the people in Iran. They are just using them as some political axis against Iran.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Masood Chajir joining us from London. Hamid Reza Olamzadeh speaking to us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thanks for contributing to this segment of the program. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. Elsewhere, the British Prime Minister facing yet another challenge to her leadership, with a Conservative lawmaker now submitting a letter of no confidence in her. Conservative lawmaker Cheryl Murray says Liz Truss's position has become untenable. That's why she has submitted a letter of no confidence to Sir Graham Brady. He's a person chairing the Committee of Conservative Lawmakers, which sets the rules for changing the party's leader. In the latest backlash against Truss, Interior Minister Suella Braverman stepped down from the cabinet following reports that she had sent an official document from her personal email thus breaking the rules. The outgoing minister used her departure as an opportunity to criticize Truss. In her resignation letter, she pointed to her concerns about the direction of the government. Another Palestinian youth losing his life due to Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian health officials say Mohammad Fadi Nouri succumbed to his injuries hours ago. He was only 16 years old. Mohammad had been injured during clashes with occupation forces at the entrance of Al Bira city last month. The health ministry reported at the time that the teenager had been shot in the abdomen. Also happening in the occupied West Bank, Palestinians are on a general strike to pay homage to Uday Tamimi, a young man who was killed in a confrontation with Israeli forces last night. They'd been chasing him for 10 days. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kandil explains what exactly triggered the violence.
What happened last night is that a Palestinian young man, Uday Tamimi, 22-year-old from the Shafat refugee camp, was killed by the Israeli forces. The story of Uday Tamimi is that 10 days ago, exactly on the 10th of October, Uday Tamimi arrived at the illegal Israeli military checkpoint that was established at the entrance to Shafat refugee camp, the hometown of Uday Tamimi. He left a vehicle, opened fire at Israeli soldiers there, killed an Israeli soldier and wounded three others. Then the manhunt for Uday Tamimi was going on since the 10th of October. All entrances to Shafat refugee camp, Anata town, and Al-Salam neighborhood in Al-Quds were completely sealed. Palestinians were not allowed to leave or enter the Shafat refugee camp. What happened last night is, again, Uday Tamimi arrived at the illegal settlement of Ma'ane Adomim near Al-Quds, near Al-Izariyya town, and he confronted the Israeli forces. The Israeli military declared that they succeeded to shot dead Uday Tamimi after a manhunt that continued for 10 days. Today in the occupied West Bank, a general strike has been declared in Al-Quds and all over the occupied West Bank. All schools had been closed, no businesses. Palestinians are saying this is the least to offer this Palestinian fighter.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Biden files.
Acres and a mule. That's right, 40 acres and a mule. After 246 years of slavery, that is what African Americans who had been enslaved were promised by the U.S. government. Well, that was back in 1865, and although that was no real compensation for 2.5 centuries of slavery, even that promise was not kept towards Black Americans. It became symbolic of all the other promises, laws, programs that were supposed to bring about more economic parity with whites for Black Americans, but never took place. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Today, we're going to take you on a journey that started centuries ago on the African continent and yet still has proportional consequences on millions of African Americans today. Estimates vary from $6 trillion to $60 trillion, the value of those 40 acres and a mule today. Well, the wealth never paid to the former slaves nor their descendants. The generational wealth that was never passed down, that opportunity, like so many others, that was never provided to blacks, while endless opportunities, grants, raises, stipends, etc., were given to white Americans. The results show a staggering difference between black and white wealth, even in America today.
In 2019, the median white household was worth $188,200. The median black household held $24,100 in wealth. White households had 7.8 times more wealth than blacks. In 2020, whites made up 60% of the U.S. population, but held 84% of the total household wealth. Black households, who constituted 13.4% of the U.S. population, held 4% of the total household wealth. White households inherit over 5.3 times more than black households. And white households are 2.8 times more likely than black households to inherit any wealth.
Well, we're going to dig into this issue further with our first guest, Cam Howard.
Cam Howard is a reparations expert who has been fighting for decades to get reparations for black Americans. He has addressed the United Nations and has traveled the world presenting the case for reparations for African Americans. He is an administrator for NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Thanks so much for being with us. Do you think that black Americans should get reparations, and if so, why?
So I certainly believe that blacks in this country should get reparations. And it's primarily because of, you know, two reasons. One, there's never been justice and fairness in any large measure for African Americans, people of African descent in this country. As you know, we came here as stolen, kidnapped people from the continent of Africa to slave in the cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields in America, and then later in some of the factories during the industrial age. The tremendous amount of crimes were committed against us during the period of enslavement. But then after the period of enslavement, we had a brief period called Reconstruction in this country where there was some semblance of fairness and justice. Then that was followed by another 80 plus years of terroristic apartheid by white supremacist organizations in this country that removed, again, all notions of fairness and justice in the areas of education, in areas of economics, in the area of labor, employment, et cetera. There was criminal punishment, criminal justice. There's been no fairness. There was no fairness. It was an apartheid system backed by the terror of the state. And then after the Jim Crow period, apartheid period in this country, in 1965 and their 60s, as a result of the civil rights movement, we had a small window of fairness and justice with the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Voting Rights Act that was passed. And then in the 70s, we had a semblance of fairness with affirmative action. But all those things have been stripped down taken away the teeth of what should have been given to us in the area of fairness and justice, they've been watered down. So when you look at the police violence in our communities, it's still a continuation of the non-fair and non-just treatment that we receive in this country. So, you know, only a brief, very brief periods in this country of African Americans ever received the type of fair and just treatment that immigrants and people who are, you know, other Americans or people who just come to America, they receive just by being within these boundaries. But African Americans as a whole, we have not shared any type of governmental fairness and justice for the long haul. Secondly, reparations are due because of the tremendous injury that we still suffer from today as a result of these hundreds of years, centuries of mistreatment in this country. When you look at every area of people of activity in this country, Blacks on the bottom of every good list, on the top of every bad list, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's criminal punishment, whether it's wealth, whether it's, you know, health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these things, you see a stark difference between Black lived experience and white lived experience in this country.
Well, what type of reparations are you proposing?
We look at reparations in the forms of, from the international law standpoint, of gross crimes committed by a state against the civilian population, where that tends to lay out what is known as full reparation. And there's five basic components. First component is cessation and guarantees of non-repetition. First, you must stop the bad acts. You must eliminate the policy that disproportionately negatively affect people of African descent in this country. That's first and foremost. The criminal justice laws, the housing laws, the economic laws that exist, the disproportionate resource allocation toward education and other aspects of our community. First, you must cease those policies and then put in place structures that ensure that those policies don't show up again. Like when enslavement ended, enslavement resurfaced for another 45 years in the form of convict leasing, in the form of sharecropping, in the form of debt peonage, where, you know, that we still existed in enslavement, but it was not called enslavement. So we need to stop these bad policies that exist today and make sure that we put in structures that they don't resurface. The second component of full reparations is restitution. How do you return the people back to where they would have been had these crimes not committed? So we're talking centuries of crime. So there's going to be multiple generations of repair that's necessary in the areas of education, in the areas of economic development and wealth building and employment and these type of areas and land acquisition and housing. All these areas have to be addressed and redressed with targeted resources. The third component is compensation. When restitution doesn't alleviate a situation, the compensation is an obligatory form of reparations under international norms. And we certainly know that in order for us to have some type of parity and wealth in this country, there's going to have to be some type of direct compensation. We don't know what that be and how much it would be, but certainly we are fighting for that because it is, again, obligatory on international law to redress the situation in its entirety. The fourth component of full reparations is satisfaction. How do you return the dignity back to a people whose dignity was eroded as a result of the crimes you committed against them? Sometimes an apology will do that. Other times, you know, museums, markers, removing a statuary, creating monuments, new monuments, curriculum overhaul, truth and reconciliation commissions, those type of things lend to dignity, return, or satisfaction. And then the fifth component is rehabilitation for the mind, heart, and spirit damage to the people as a result of the crimes. Black people in America have the worst health profile among any people. Our health profile is similar to those in quote-unquote third world countries in certain areas. Highest rates of cancer, highest rate of heart attack, highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality, as I stated, highest rates of breast cancers among women, the highest rates of testicular cancer or prostate cancer among men. I mean, the health profile is terrible. And we know now through transgenerational epigenetic inheritance that health profile is a result of the historical trauma we've experienced as a people in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Cam Howard. Well, we're going to take a look at a few instances that have taken a place over the years and why African Americans are demanding reparations. You know, slavery launched modern capitalism and actually turned the United States into the wealthiest country in the world. Looking at this cotton production, I mean, by the 1830s, 77% of U.S. cotton was used for the British textile industry. And look at that, 2.25 billion pounds of cotton in 1859. And, you know, the cotton actually built New York City as a commercial and financial center. And if you look at the whole worth after the outbreak of the Civil War and the values of slaves, $3 billion, 48% of total wealth in the South in 1860. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave lost or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans was never in place for African Americans, not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction, as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations is money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, you know, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that if we are, the question around reparations should also include the continent of Africa. I think that, you know, the first thing should be they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and you know, the wealth. They stole us. They stole humans. You know, so we totally believe that reparations should be paid. But will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, you know, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash, because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable and make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few quote unquote African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination and you don't have a place of your own and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth, because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as, and treated like domesticated animals, you know. So they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal, you know. Even on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects. You know, even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happen to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans, and we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved, because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles, or like we were some type of plants, or some type of exotic horse. You know what I'm saying? Like we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than, like I said, domesticated animals. Like we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved, we were tortured, and to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Changa, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote unquote, third world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time. And we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team right here next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi. We are up to key number 4, which is protecting oneself from harm. And we also looked at key number 1, which is to think, contemplate, and reflect. Key number 2, seeking knowledge. And key number 3, to work and have perseverance. And we got up to key number 4, which is to take care of ourselves. Obviously, you know, it comes right after work because you are required to keep yourself healthy and fit, not only to work, but also to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When it comes to protecting ourselves, the elements and the means of safety, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, they went right, left, and center in trying to educate me of how to keep ourselves safe, especially when it comes to the body. And truly, if we listen to the words of the infallibles, the words of the holy imams, surely we will not go wrong.
surely will have no problems if we listen to their advices, to their prescriptions. You will not be sick. You will not see a doctor. Only if we listen, that's a problem. When it comes to how should I take care of myself, I'm going to read the words of the infallibles themselves, and you be the judge. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says, and he gives a full prescription to having an absolute healthy body as long as you live. He says, من أكل الطعام على النقاء, he, whoever eats his food, being in the state of purity, so it is not najis, not expired, you know, it's clean, it's good to eat. وأجاد الطعام التمغضا, and he chews his food, because now these days we eat in a hurry, we swallow, we don't chew anymore. وترك الطعام وهو يشتهيه, and then he gets up from the meal while he still, you know, feel like he wants to eat more. He's still hungry. وَلَمْ يَحْبِسَ الْغَائِطْ إِذَا أَتَاهُ, and he does not hold his bowels when they come. لَمْ يَمْرُضْ إِلَّا مَرَضَ الْمَوْتِ, he will not be sick until death. Now, how clearer could Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam be when it comes to us not getting sick? Simple. Eat pure food. Make sure you overchew it, and make sure you don't overeat. That's it, as simple as that. And then you will not be sick. A prescription many have applied, especially those who are religious and, you know, spiritual, and even healthy people these days do. And you hardly see them getting sick. They don't overeat. They don't... they chew their food very well. They don't swallow their food. And they relieve themselves whenever time permits or time allows. So therefore, they don't get sick. As simple as that. And Ahl Bayt alayhim salam, they go in even more further details. Now, let us take a short break. And then we will see how other Imams alayhim salam tell us how me and you can keep ourselves safe, especially when Imam Ali alayhi salam gives certain advices to his son Imam Al-Hasan alayhi salam. If we apply, we surely will be safe. A break, and then we will return.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafati, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program The Keys of Life. We are at key number 4, how to keep yourself safe. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in his will to his son, Al-Imam Al-Hasan alayhi salam, he says to him, son, ألا أعلمك أربع خصال تستغني بها عن الطب؟ Should I not teach you four things that if you apply, you will not need medicine? Now, I don't know about you, but I do want to know what these four things are, because I surely don't like doctors and I don't want to go to a clinic either. And I'm sure neither are you. So I'm sure you're also nodding your head right now saying, yes, tell us, what are these four things? And they are very easy to apply. They're not hard, mind you. He says to him, لا تجلس على الطعام إلا وأنت جائع. Do not sit on a meal unless you are hungry. Law number one, don't eat unless you are hungry. These days, we can hardly control ourselves, like moving and eating. We eat wherever we see. And the imam says, that's wrong. So number one, to not seeing a doctor, do not eat unless you're hungry. Two, he says, وَلَا تُقُمْ عَنِ الطَّعَامِ إِلَّا وَأَنْتَ تَشْتَهِيهِ. And when you get up from the meal, make sure you get up while you have desire to eat. You're not full yet. Eating until you are full and plotted, that's a one-way ticket to a hospital, to a doctor. So eat only when you're hungry, rule number one. Rule number two, when you eat, make sure you stay hungry. And rule number three, the Imam alayhi salam, وَجُودِ الْمَضْغِ and chew your food when you eat. And like I said before, that's one of our issues. And lastly, the Imam alayhi salam says, وَإِذَا نِمْتَ فَعْرِضْ نَفْسَكَ عَلَى الْخَلَاءِ. Before you sleep, make sure you go to the bathroom. Empty bowels, empty bladder, and go to sleep. If you do these four things, Imam Ali alayhi salam says to his son, Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, فَإِذَا اسْتَعْمَلْتَ هَذَا اسْتَغْنَيْتَ عَنِ الطِّبِّ. If you do these things, then you will not need medicine. As simple as these things, it's easily said, hardly practiced. When my mom makes all this nice, juicy, spicy food, me trying not to fill my stomach up, it's a battle. It's a battle with myself. But at the end of the day, either I need to fulfill my desires or keep myself, my body healthy. The choice is yours. We could be obese in hospitals, or we could be healthy and fit by just following four simple rules of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Don't overeat. Eat when you're hungry. Go to the bathroom and chew your food. As simple as that. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.